This is an interview with Dr. Henry Pito at the top of McArdle Laboratory. Today is September 11th, 2013. I'm Molly Voss. So Dr. Pito, you began to be chair of pathology here at UW in 1968. So why did you take the job?
Well, the pathology department goes back to the early part of the 20th century when a German whose name, again, I can't remember, came and became chairman of the department. And he was of the classical school in which the Department of Pathology basically began and ended in the autopsy room. And pathology had changed quite a bit since 1916, I think it was when he took the department over. And Dr. Angevine, who was chairman just before I was, had just followed this component. He really didn't do anything different. So the autopsy room was right in the middle of the department. It was over in SMI. And what happened was this isolated the department from the clinical staff. And so that really the department became just that what it was, the autopsy room. Surgical pathology, which is usually an integral part of the pathology department, became a part of the Department of Medicine. It was run by a pathologist, Dr. Walter Jeske, who is a superb surgical pathologist, and he had an appointment in pathology. But the surgical pathology itself was not part of the department. Well, fortunately, Dr. Angevine changed that about 2 years before he retired, and it became a part of the Department of Pathology. But that wasn't... I had one of my going to various places for interviews for a possible faculty position. I would say 80 to 90% of them were pathology departments. And virtually in all the other departments of pathology, clinical pathology, which is laboratory medicine, was part of the department. Well, again, here, the clinical pathology had been developed, and the person who was running it, Dr. Frank Larson, was very competent. He was an internist. And what he did was he surrounded himself with some outstanding, basically analytical chemists. And he developed the clinical laboratory so that they were quite a good operation. As far as the hospital concerned, they were the biggest money maker, I think, in the hospital. And now that is a little unusual because most other medical schools, clinical pathology is part of the Department of Pathology, and the money they generate, a good chunk of it goes to the Department of Pathology. So therefore, the pathology department is fairly well heeled in most medical schools, and it plays a very important role. Matter of fact, if you go back in medical schools back into the 19th century, pathology was basically most of the medical school. But at the University of Wisconsin, it was just the opposite. Pathology was sort of the low person on the clinical totem pole, at any rate. Well, I think I had just gone to Yale and had been offered the department, the chairmanship there, and Dr. Peter Eichmann, who was dean, had discussed it with me, and he offered me position here. And again, it was the same thing, what was at Yale and what was here. Well, if I became chairman of pathology here, I could still keep my laboratory here. Dr. Rush had no problem with that. And I thought that it was naively that it wouldn't be too much of a problem. So I elected to become chairman with the specified idea And I think I talked to Dr. Eichmann about this, but it was certainly in my own mind, that I would remain chair for 3 years or so, build the department up, because it was a very, there were a few people who had been around for years in the department, very nice people. But nationally, with I guess one exception, really weren't known at all. The house staff program was almost defunct. And so what I really, my reason for taking the chair was to build the department up. And the other thing was that I told Dr. Eichmann, first of all, I wouldn't take the chair unless the clinical labs became part of the Department of Pathology. Well, that went over like a lead balloon. Department of Medicine screamed and yelled about that. So I finally gave in and I said, well, as a minimum, the head of the clinical labs should have a joint appointment in pathology. So they bought that. And just to jump ahead a little bit, it turns out that after I transferred to here as the director, there were about three chairmen, I think, three or four chairmen, one of whom was a basic scientist, not even a pathologist. And the dean finally at that time, Larry Crowley, was dean, and he saw that, you know, it was really necessary, so that in order to recruit somebody from the outside, the clinical labs became part of the Department of Pathology. So it did happen in the future, but not while I was chairman.
About what year was that?
I became chairman in 68. I switched over to here in 71. And I think that happened in 72 or 73, something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But at any rate, that was what got me into pathology. Well, I maintained my laboratory, and the only reason it kept going, and this was true while I served as acting dean, was that I had some outstanding postdocs who really ran the lab. And so I could get by with spending a minimal amount of time supervising. I did a little bit of lab work, actually. We did some work on things, but it wasn't like it was before I got into this administrative mess. So then what happened was that after a couple of years, and we were very fortunate, we brought in a young neuropathologist who was a real go-getter, and he built the house staff program. And it's interesting, the way he did it was he recruited osteopaths, people who had their osteopathic degrees, and the AMA had recognized osteopathic medicine, and people could, there were four-year programs. From there, they can go into AMA-recognized residency programs. So we got about, I think, at least four house staff, two of which were outstanding, who went through the whole residency program. And I got out of it an outstanding graduate student in George Michalopoulos, who inquired about coming over here to, George is now chairman of the Department of Pathology at Pittsburgh, University of Pittsburgh. But he was the one person that really, because he was a graduate student of mine in addition to being a resident. And he went through the first year or so of residency, then he spent the rest of the time working on his PhD. And then he finished his residency when he finished his PhD. So that was very good from my standpoint. It helped the department because, again, the service responsibilities of the department were the autopsy room. And one thing we lacked was a forensic pathologist. And in the city of Madison at that time, the coroner was basically the forensic pathologist for the city. Well, which means you could get away with murder, literally, if you watch some of these television programs. But we finally managed to get through the VA. We managed to get an individual who, personality-wise, had some quirks, but he was really an outstanding pathologist and a forensic pathologist. But before that, we very rarely did autopsies for the coroner. He would occasionally ask us, but you had to charge him. And of course, he had a limited budget, so he wasn't going to go beyond his budget. Well, I remember the first year I was chairman, there was some sort of a murder-suicide in town. It involved six people, a family of children, a wife, and I think the husband killed himself or something like that. But the coroner was up a creek because he had to autopsy all these people and determine the cause of death. So we did this for him. And the advantage of that is we got some cash, which the department had no other than what the regular budget was, cash to do anything with. And I remember being in the autopsy room. I'm not a forensic pathologist. But as I recall, Dr. Bloodworth had just come into the department, and he came over and helped. And so we had a pretty good operation at that time. But at any rate, that was part of that. Now, since that time, there is a forensic pathologist. There was in the department the bushy-haired guy with the beard. But he was an outstanding person. Again, a few quirks, but was really superb. And he did all the pathology, basically, for the state of Wisconsin, for coroners all over the state, except Milwaukee, because Milwaukee had a medical examiner system. And the state of Wisconsin, this is getting a little off a bit, but the rule at that time was that a center that had, I think, 300,000 or 400,000 people in it could opt to have a medical examiner. Well, at that time, it eliminated everybody but Milwaukee. So Milwaukee did opt to have a medical examiner, and they did. And that is really the way to do things, because there you have a board-certified forensic pathologist and hopefully some staff and a lab and whatnot, which Milwaukee did have. Now the law has changed, and in fact there is a forensic pathologist, there is a medical examiner, for the city of, it's Dane County, I think. As a matter of fact, it may be several counties, because they can do that, with get several counties together, and that satisfies the 400,000 or whatever it was. And so that relieved the department, the university, of doing anything like that. Or anybody in the city, there were local pathologists here who used to do things for the coroner too. So, but that was one thing that happened while I was involved. But anyway, we recruited some other people. One very good person by the name of Burkholder, who was a renal pathologist, and all of these satisfy the demand of the clinicians, because they had no interaction with pathology other than surgical pathology, which is not part of the department. So Dr. Dudley, who is the one that the neuropathologist, the young fellow who developed the training program, he was a neuropathologist and interacted quite well with the neurology department. Burkhalter is a renal pathologist who did renal biopsies and read them, and the renal people over in medicine just went wild. They thought this was the greatest thing happening. And then, out of the clear blue sky, we had a woman come in and see me one time. Her name was Enid Gilbert. And she asked if she could perhaps get a visiting professor position in the department. Well, Dr. Gilbert was board certified in clinical anatomical pathology and also a board certified pediatrician. So I wasn't about to say no. And it turned out that for the first year, the department didn't have to pay anything because she had, I think, the deal, it was some deal that went on. Her husband was on a fellowship here. Well, maybe we did have to pay some, but I forgot what it was. But at any rate, Enid was absolutely outstanding. And fortunately, all these people stayed on in the department after I got out. Burkhalter became chairman after I did, Burkhalter. And Enid stayed here for quite a few years. Unfortunately, one of her children, I think, committed suicide. And it really, it ended up with she and her husband getting a divorce. And then eventually she moved on. But she comes back here every year because her husband is a very well-known clinician, physiologist. And they have there's a seminar that's under her name. But at any rate, that really helped the department tremendously. So I thought, you know, after a couple of years, it was about time for me to get out. But I was trying to figure out how I could do this without getting in trouble with the dean. Well,
why you would get in trouble with the dean?
Well, because, I mean, just a couple of years as chairman, I never mentioned it. I'm not sure I mentioned anything. I was just going to stay for 3 years. But at any rate, I took what I thought was the easy way out, which was crazy, but I don't know what I had in mind. But at any rate, the chancellor called me up and asked me if I would become acting dean, because the dean resigned. And it took me a little while to figure that one out. So I said, well, I would under specific circumstances, and that is I would take it for a year. And at the end of the year, if I didn't feel that I could continue, then I would bow out. So he said that was okay.
Why do you think the chancellor asked you?
Hmm?
Why did the chancellor ask you to be acting dean?
I don't know, he was looking for a sucker or something. But I'm not sure. But interesting enough, there are a number of the deans of medical schools around the country are pathologists. And part of the reason is that the pathologist sort of sits on two areas, basic science and at the same time clinical science. So maybe that was the idea, that since I had both fields that I could work in. But at any rate, what had happened was at the time I became dean, there was a push to keep the medical school here but expand it versus move it out to where it is now. And that won. I was against that, but that didn't make any difference. And the thing that was hanging in the air was that to move out there, I've forgotten what the whole cost was estimated to be, but it was this was about 1970. I think it was 60 mil or something like that. It was a large, very large figure. And they had convinced the state to come up with a certain amount of that. And then they expected us to go into the federal government, who at that time were building medical schools. They were paying for medical schools. So we had a grant into the medical, into the federal government for $10 million. And I think that was the largest grant that was, you know, presented. So this was really on the brink of disappearing, because the state said, yeah, we'll do it if you get the grant. And the grant was really iffy. And then there was also something, I think they had to, the state was willing to put money in, but then they had to bond the rest of it. So what happened was, we did get the grant, and the state came up with their chunk, but not as much as we'd hoped. And the bonding was there too, but not what it is. So I think the original medical school that was out there and the hospital was built for about 40 mil, 40 or 50 mil, something like that. And they started construction while I was still acting dean, I think. If not, it was very shortly thereafter. At any rate, that was a big part of my deanship, was to try to get that thing squared away. The other was that the big push in the country was for family physicians. That was considered to be, because was needed. We needed physicians, but we needed physicians that would take care of what are called primary care. And there was a family physician residency, actually. It was a 3-year residency. And people could do that. Now, Wisconsin was very high on this because they had what they called a preceptorship program, which was medical students would go out and work with usually primary care physicians, but sometimes surgeons or sometimes at small hospitals. And that was part of their training. They had, I think they spent 6 weeks or 2 months. And they were taken care of when they went there. In other words, their room and board was there. But that was all. And they had to do whatever the local, they were called preceptors. And there were about 25 of them, I think, something like that. And many of them had been doing this, because this started way back in the 20s or something like that. And so this was part of the push to have the family physicians and a family practice program developed in the medical school. Well, you can imagine the medical school that, for one thing, was so conservative that the pathology department was in the autopsy room. And there was a fight between medicine and surgery that was absolutely a knockdown, drag-out affair, which didn't end. And when I got into it, it was still there.
What was it about?
Well, it was about the surgeons saw themselves. One thing, the monies that people generated, you see, you charged patients for the physician's thing. That went into the departmental. They had a departmental pot. And from that, much of the salary of a clinician would be had. Well, if you stop and think, the amount of money that an internist can make versus the amount of money that a general surgeon or a neurosurgeon or somebody like that makes is almost an order of magnitude difference. So that was one reason. And part of that, too, was the reason that the chairman never got along. The chairman had been here for quite a while. And so it really just festered. It was really a wound in the school. It festered for a long time. Well, when there was an attempt to set up a family practice program, these people would have none of it, because they thought, I mean, these people have an internship and that's it, which wasn't really true. But there were several people in the medical school, I can't remember, one was Tom Meyer, who was an internist, who really was pushing the thing. Plus, the big push was from the legislature. I mean, they had been hearing all this from their constituents. Gee, we got to have docs in this state. So the legislature was very much, you know, for this. Well, what happened was that, again, it was during my tenure as dean, we finally, through a lot of machinations, we had meetings of the clinician, the departmental chairman, and we had, Tom Meyer helped out tremendously, discussions where we'd sort of put on the blackboard what the main problems were, and then how you could attack them, and then take a vote with everybody. And you did this, I've forgotten what it was called, it had a specific name, but it worked out pretty well, actually. And that we met at a neutral ground, which is the State Medical Society, which helped, I think, a little bit. But at any rate, the faculty finally did agree to have a Department of Family Medicine, and then that department could set up a residency program in family medicine, which has continued to date. So that was another big problem. there's another one, but I can't remember what it was. But at any rate, those I got squared away. One thing was is to try to get, one of the big factors was the chairman of surgery was very negative with respect to anything to do with medicine or pediatrics or anything else. So I was fortunate to convince a friend who was a pediatrician to be the clinical, the associate dean for clinical affairs. Dick Hong was his name. He's a very nice guy. And he had the personality in which he could talk with clinicians and get them to sort of do things, because you got an awful lot of prima donnas, particularly in surgery. So he convinced, and he also, we had the agreement of the chancellor, to have the chairman of surgery take a position in the chancellor's office. It'd be a higher salary, it'd be more prestige and all that. And then we could bring in a new chairman of surgery. So that happened with Dick, and we recruited an individual by the name of Fred Belzer, who wasn't a general surgeon. I've forgotten exactly what his subspecialty was. But at any rate, he turned out to be a superb chairman of surgery, and he got along with the medical people. And there was a lot of fences mended when that happened. So that all happened in about 2.5 years. And then the other thing that happened was that Dr. Rush, the cancer program started under Mr. Nixon. And Dr. Rush was one of the members of the committee, the original committee developed by Nixon, to set up how this was going to work. And Harold was, again, you know, just an astute person politically and future thinking. So he saw the handwriting on the wall that there was going to be out of this cancer center. And in fact, right away, there were three cancer centers designated. One was Sloan Kettering, one was MD Anderson, and I've forgotten who the third one may have been, Harvard, but I don't think so. Maybe it was Hopkins. But at any rate, there were three of them. And they were automatically designated. But then after that, then you had to go through and put in grants and make everything. So Harold did that. He was got into that full time. Well, immediately the department, this department, reacted to that and said, well, listen, if you're going to do that full time, we don't really think you can be chairman. So Harold, I think he realized that. And he just wanted to put his, because his ultimate goal was to have a clinical center and McArdle as a unit, which has now happened, but not to the best liking of people in this department, I'm sure. And it's happened in an odd way. But at any rate, so I guess then the department basically said, well, we're going to have another chairman. And I've forgotten how, at that time they voted, and my name came up.
So did you put your name forward, or did they just choose
No,
you?
I didn't put my name forward. I think probably Dr. Potter and Dr. Rush did. And the argument was that I'd had a lot of administrative experience, which I had by that time, more than I wanted. But to run this department doesn't take an administrator. It takes a scientist and a person who can interact with scientists. So at any rate, there was a vote taken, and my name came up. So as I told you last time, I went around and talked to every faculty member and asked them, I mean, what would you do if I were chairman? Is this something that you could work with? So basically all of them said yes. So I agreed. And the chancellor knew of my interests. And I had written a letter to the chancellor. And the vice chancellor, Shane was the fellow's name. He and I interacted extremely well. He was a chemist, and I'm probably a chemist at heart, so we interacted extremely well together. But at any rate, he agreed that I could step down from the deanship and become the director of McArdle. And this happened 20 months, 7 days, 5 hours after I started the deanship. I was counting every minute of it. But that was when, of course, as I told you last time, that I got into, Betty Miller agreed to be the associate director. And that was a critical part as far as I was concerned, because I knew good and well that I couldn't do the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. How did you split duties between you and Betty Miller?
Well, I was the, you might say, the talker, and Betty was the doer. Betty interacted really very well with all the faculty members. I would do it, but I didn't have time. And she would go around and sort of take the pulse of the department. And then, as I said, we met for an hour or two before every faculty meeting. And we met once a week. And we discussed how things were and everything. And then also in the grants, she and Ilsa. Betty, you must have been involved in some of those too. Yeah, were you working with Ilsa when I was... Yeah, okay. See how my memory... but at any rate, that's why, I mean, they were the doers. And I essentially tried to go on the national scene. And I had been a member of different study sections, and I'd been chairman of a training grant committee for the NIH. And then I think, again, through Harold's, he must have had some background, something or other, I was appointed to the National Cancer Advisory Board. And that, I think, was, it didn't say anything about me, but it said something about the department, because then you got the department at a national level. And I was on that thing for 6 years and became chairman of it, actually. I was chairman for 3 years. And that took a lot of time. So that's why I say Betty really maintained things while I sort of tried to keep the department at the national level.
Mm-hmm. So your involvement with the board was the National Cancer Advisory Board was primarily to raise the profile of McArdle, or did you have other reasons?
No. The National Cancer Advisory Board, their reason for existence was to act as an advisory committee to the National Cancer Institute and to the National Cancer Program. Now, there was also another group of three people called the President's Cancer Panel. Exactly what they did never really became obvious. I think it was mainly for show, but it was very important if you became a member of it. And actually, later on, I did, so which helped the department again. But that, I think, it was nothing like the NCAB. The National Cancer Advisory Board actually also did some policy conditions for the NCI. There were a number of things, I can't remember them all now, that came up while I was on the board that had to be acted on and determined. So you got to know a lot of the ins and outs of the NCI and the government. It is of interest that the director of the institutes one day called me in and asked me if I would be interested in being the director of the National Cancer Institute. I told him no.
When was this?
There was no way I was going to get involved in that. But because the director was resigning, I think, and this person, I can't remember who was the director of the NIH, but I remember being called into his office. He talked to me about it, said they were interested in considering me as a candidate, and I said, save your time.
You didn't want to get involved in further administrative duties?
No, that's not just administrative, that's political,
yeah.
And national, at the national level, and you just, you certainly would step out of science when you did that. You'd never go back into science. Whereas, fortunately, through all of this, my laboratory was maintained, and we published a fair amount of material during that time. So I could do the things. You could do that as director. And actually, Dr. Rush did that. He had a laboratory, too. But you could not do that as director of the NCI. So that was just one thing along the way. But so that's really, I think, the way we sort of divided things. It was just an understood type thing. Now, if things got testy in the department, there were a few times, like months with Václav, I remember. And I can't remember the details, though. So that maybe there were a couple of others. then that was my responsibility to do that. And I ran the staff meetings. And so that was basically the thing. But it was something which you couldn't maintain a laboratory at 100% by any means. But you could keep a lab going pretty well, particularly if you had good fellows and that could run things while you were not there. And I did more traveling at that time, not just in this country, but internationally, than I care to think of.
Did you have any major goals for McArdle while you were its director?
Well, Harold had gotten us the new building. One thing we needed was a new animal facility, and we were able to get that through the a grant from the NCI. And what happened was, it was over in the old hospital, this wing of the old hospital, the top, I think it was the top two or three floors. And it was all revamped and everything, so that the big advantage was when you were working with carcinogens, which the Millers were, the OSHA rules had really come down hard on laboratories. You couldn't just go around and feed things without any definitive protection. And so those labs, those mantle rooms over there were very well built, and they had, you know, the appropriate air pressure and whatnot, and the people working in them were very protected from any exposure to carcinogens or anything like that. So that made a big, that was a big advance in the department. I'm just trying to think. I don't think the whole building, this building was, when it was built, the whole fourth floor was empty. It was just a shell. And that was, for one thing, that had to do with budget. And the other, of course, was expansion. When the building was built, there were 10 faculty members, and I think we expanded to, maybe you remember that better than I, Betty, better 16 or something like that. One thing, as I mentioned last time, that Harold, and was really a rule in the department, that there were no joint appointments. And that sort of isolated the department from some other departments on the campus, because they thought we were aloof. But there was a real reason for it, because with joint appointments, as I went through last time, you don't have that devotion and that you do when a person is here full-time in the department. When you're split with your allegiances, it's quite different. So I think that's one thing that kept the department together during those years. Dr. Dove finally ended up getting asked for a joint appointment in genetics. But again, his was the same situation as mine. I don't think he was ever paid by genetics. Do you know, Betty?
No,
I wasn't ever paid by pathology. Until later on, I was paid by some practice money, because as a practicing physician, I became part of the practice plan. And therefore, you automatically got some money from that. But in fact, it never had anything to do with my regular salary. It should be pointed out that the salary that you get, as far as when you retire, the only thing that counts is the money you get from the state. So practice plan money didn't mean anything for retirement. And thus, for example, you'd have, back in the old days, in the 20s and 30s, surgeons would maybe get $6,000 a year from the state. But their practice, they get quite a bit. So, but only the $6,000 counted towards their retirement, so obviously they had to set up something else.
So,
go ahead. No, I was just, we hit a sort of thing here. What else did you want to know about McArdle?
I mean, so were there any, and I guess any other goals you might have had for McArdle at the time, or was it primarily your intention as director was to keep everybody happy here, or?
Well, to make it an outstanding, and to keep it as an outstanding research component. And what happened was that there was a lot of association with other departments, mainly not in the medical school, but in other departments. And this was joint research programs, and that extended quite a bit, which was good for the department. I mean, the research programs were really excellent. The thing that sort of started the joint appointment thing was that the dean, there was a deanship involved, and there was a dean, and I can't remember his name, who only lasted a few years. But one of his requirements was that he should have a joint appointment in McArdle. Well, you know, I was dead set against it, but you got a lot of pressure from the higher ups, and a joint appointment of a dean wouldn't mean very much. I mean, he didn't have any lab in the department, and it might be good, you know, from the department standpoint of doing well in the medical school. Unfortunately, I think he and I had a couple of run-ins, so that didn't help. But at any rate, he was that really. After that, then when I stepped down and Norman became chairman, then joint appointments increased. And that's just the way it worked. But
so, are there any particular challenges that face you as director here?
You see, actually, when I was director, money was pretty fluid. So it was a good time to be director. Because Harold started things out, and then the National Cancer Program increased in size by, I don't know, quite a bit, hundreds of millions of dollars. And as a result, grants were available and the various other things, like we got that construction grant. I think we got a grant, too, to redo our in this building, to redo the air handling component in this building. And that was from the feds. I don't think the state, if they put anything into it, it was very small. McArdle was basically self-sufficient. And I was fortunate in the last few years that I was director, the dean of the medical school I knew very well. He was a pathologist. And whenever we'd have a site visit for the program project grant, or another, then it became a cancer center core grant, is what it was. And we were one of the few basic science centers that had a core grant. Everything else of the cancer centers, and there were about close to 20 of them, were clinical and basic science. And there was always an argument to try to get McArdle to connect with the clinical center, which of course by the latter part of my direction, it started in the late 70s, when Paul Carbone was recruited here, and the building had been built out there. The building was built with an enormous squeeze, meaning that when the original architectural plans came out, there was plush space for all the clinicians and everybody. They had offices and clinics and laboratories and everything. Well, then when the squeeze came on, then everybody had to figure out how they could live in a certain amount of space. And that was a big problem. And the architects had gotten in and convinced, I guess, the people here that the way that hospital is built is that there are alternating floors. There's a floor like this. Then on top of that is a floor which has nothing in it. And it's not quite as tall, but it's about 8 or 9 feet. And so you have intervening spaces, floors, between each of the floors in that hospital and the centers. Now, I don't think that the new research wings are different, but the original building is built like that. Well, I mean, their argument was that this would allow you to change anything at a moment's notice. You could go in there and, you know, run things quickly through and change the walls of everything like that. Well, I was fine in the hospital, but they forgot about a couple of things. One is, you have to heat that place and air condition. I think they ended up, the first year they ran that thing, the heating and air conditioning was $1 million. And that was considering that the university runs its own heating plants. And so you're really basically talking about air conditioning units, but and electricity for them. So that's a pretty big amount of money. I think the university foots that bill. That's indirect costs and whatnot. So now I don't know what happens now because the hospital is a separate unit, but. Anyways, that was one of the things that I think people really didn't think about at the moment, because that could have been easily a 10-story building out there, that hospital. And it almost is now. But in fact, about 40% of it is unusable space. So it's... but at any rate, that was different.
So, sort of moving back a bit to your directorship with McArdle, is there anything that you disliked about the job?
Did I what?
Disliked about being the director?
Well, only that it kept me away from the lab more than I'd like. Other than that, it was sort of rewarding to be able to help my colleagues, because Harold had really taught me very definitely that the director's job is to keep everybody doing the best thing they can. And that's the way I ran things.
So why did you step down when you decided to do so?
Well, I figured I'd done it enough. You know, you sit around, you've been something long enough, and at that time I was 61, and that would give me another 5 or 10 years that I could at least do a few things, you know, and have a younger person come in and do it. And and there was a problem, actually, because again, the department, the rule is, of course, at the university, or I don't know if that's a rule or what it is, but departments elect their chairman, but that's not true in the clinical departments. And I don't know what it is, but I think on the Hill, a lot of departments do that because the chairmanship is looked on as a chore. Nobody wants it. But here in the basic science departments, it was in some looked as a, you know, some big thing you can do. It wasn't a chore. So you'd always get into a problem. But McArdle always had, well, there really wasn't, other than my own, when I was elected as directorship, that was the only time that that came up. So when I resigned, then it came up again. And there was a lot of discussion, I remember that, at that time. And the person who really, I think, steered us to the right way was Howard Tennant. Howard had a lot of influence in the department. There's no question about that. And his support and the Miller's support of Norman, because Norman was only an associate professor at that time, and I think he'd only been an associate professor for a short time. But people, I think, recognized his genius. The problem is no one had any ideas how he would. You had to do some administration in this chair. How you fit in that. So, but fortunately it worked out very well. And Norman adapted to administration. It's much easier to adapt to administration than it is to the scientific aspect of things. If you're not a scientist but an administrator, adapting to interacting with scientists is very, very, very difficult. On the other hand, if you're a scientist and you have to do some administration, particularly if you're as smart as Norman, you can learn how to nut and flat. So.
Well, great. I think that's all my questions for this session. Thanks so much.
Oh, good. Okay.